Chapter 7.
Well, I suppose that could have gone worse, grumbled Gorm, dusting the soot from his rucksack. Black dust covered the pack, and the kobold sitting atop it had been singed, but Laruna's fireballs had otherwise left his gear unharmed.
Maybe, but not by much.
Bert produced a cigarette from his vest and lit it on a smoldering shrub.
Do you think he'll catch her before she makes it back to camp?
There was a distant scream and the roar of a fiery blast.
Aye, said Gorm.
They heard Thane approaching from the woods before Gorm had finished cleaning off his pack. The troll normally moved in total silence, given his species' natural talent for lurking, but an angry mage makes a lot of noise. As they got closer, Gorm could make out Thane's attempts to negotiate amidst the screams, punctuated by periodic blasts of fire.
This is all a misunder- whoosh! What I mean to say is that once we whoosh... The thing is that the fire is really painful, so if froosh!
By the time Thane climbed down the ravine, his head was hairless, charred, and covered in painful-looking blisters.
You talk to her!
The troll snarled as he dropped Laruna unceremoniously on the ground. With a final snort, he stamped over to the deepest part of the creek and plunged his head in. A cloud of steam bloomed around his neck.
All right, easy, Laruna, easy, said Gorm, approaching the solomancer with his hands up. We're safe here. There's a good lass. You're all right.
Laruna didn't look all right. Her unfocused eyes darted wildly about as she gasped for air in short staccato gulps.
She's in traumatic shock, Bert said, peeking out from behind a rock a safe distance away. It's a natural physiological reaction.
Thane pulled his head from the stream.
A what?
He shouted.
A physiological reaction, said Bert. The body can't deal with what the eyes are seeing. That's why she's gasping like that. She needs to take some slow, deep breaths.
If you say as much, Gorm turned back to Laruna. Lass, you're having a natural illogical reaction. Uh-oh.
Laruna's breathing had already slowed considerably. Now her nostrils flared with each slow, deep breath, but it would be fatally inaccurate to describe her as calm. She stared at Gorm with sudden intensity.
You. You're with the troll?
Gorm backed away.
Now let's not jump to conclusions, lass. He's a friend.
I don't have trolls for friends, said the solomancer, standing. You might if you stopped trying to burn them alive,
Thane hollered before plunging his head back into the stream.
Listen, Thane's been a friend to all of us for a long time, said Gorm.
A long time?
Said Laruna, her eyes narrowing.
How would you know that?
Just hear me out, lass, said Gorm.
Talk, growled Laruna.
It'd be easier to talk to you if your hands weren't on fire like that, said Gorm.
Laruna's hair burst into flame as orange light flared from her eyes.
But we'll make do, Gorm said hurriedly. Listen, ain't you ever wondered why we don't get bothered by more monsters and bandits out here? Didn't you expect more assassins from King Handor to be on our tail? Well, it weren't for lack of threats. Thane here's been protecting us.
Maybe, but all of your evidence is stuff that didn't happen, Laruna said.
What about the headhunter thing?
The what?
The rib taker? I don't remember what it was called.
Gorm waved his hand as if to brush the nomenclature aside.
The big monster that Datar had back at the Ashen Tower. Ain't you ever wondered what happened to it? Why a lich's big nasty creation suddenly just went away and left us alone?
As Gorm spoke, the flames wreathing Laruna faded away. Her skepticism did not.
Perhaps the troll did kill the monster, but if that's when it started allegedly helping, it's been lurking in the woods and trailing us for months. Am I to believe it's just stalking us out of the goodness of its heart?
I wasn't stalking you, said Thane, returning from the stream.
It took longer than normal for his regenerative flesh to heal from burns, but the last of his scars were smoothing away, and fresh hair was sprouting around his ape-like face.
I was journeying with you.
You can't do anything with someone if they don't know you're there,
Laruna shot back.
We trusted you, Gorm, but it sounds like you've had a troll following us for a year without telling anybody.
He told me, said Bert.
Not helping, Gorm muttered.
Really?
Demanded the solomancer.
You told the kobold, and not the rest of us.
Oh, come now, he lives in me rucksack,
Gorm protested. It's hard to keep secrets from someone who sleeps next to your unmentionables.
Ugh, don't remind me,
Bert shuddered. The point is that we all should have known about a troll among us, said Laruna. You should be on our side, not the troll's.
I ain't picking sides, because we're all on the same one,
said Gorm. How can you be so sure? Said Laruna. For all you know, the troll is working on some cunning plot for its own dark devices.
Okay, the language here is getting very hurtful, said Thane. You get used to it, Bert told him. Does that sound like a troll to you?
Asked Gorm.
How many stories have you heard about trolls with the smarts and patience for that kind of scheme?
Not helping,
said Thane. How many stories have you heard about trolls protecting bands of professional heroes? Laruna shot back.
Just one, said Gorm, back in the Mirewood.
What, you mean the...
The clouds of Laruna's stormy countenance broke, and realization shone through.
You're the king in the wood.
I was,
said Thane.
But that means... It's you.
Laruna looked directly into the troll's eyes for the first time.
You're what Kaith is talking to. You're the one she's always saying she's connected to.
She said that?
The troll's face broke into a sudden grin, prompting the mage to take a step back.
What else did she say about me?
But, so, Kaitha knows about the troll?
Laruna looked like she was grasping for any thread of coherence that she could latch onto.
No, she knows about the king in the wood,
said Gorm.
It's a big difference,
sighed Thane.
She knows you're there, Laruna said. I mean, she talks like she has feelings for you. So, unless you also... Oh.
Oh! They catch on eventually,
Bert told the troll.
But a troll and an elf... That can't be right,
sputtered the mage.
I mean, right? That's just not right.
I understand that it's an improbable situation,
said Thane.
There's an understatement, muttered Bert. I mean, physically, it's not helping,
the others chorused.
But she's out there looking for you,
said the Solomancer.
Why not just... Well, I suppose I know why.
Thane interrupted her fumbling.
We all know why.
But you should still be honest,
pressed Laruna.
She might be... Well, she might not... Not...
Scream and run away,
said Bert.
Shoot him in the face multiple times,
said Gorm.
Refer to me as an it,
said Thane.
Well, right.
The maid shuffled her feet awkwardly. Gorm watched warring thoughts move across her face like armies over a field. He recalled having a similar mental battle a while ago. It was hard to reconcile who Thane was with what he looked like. But Laruna settled internal conflicts the same way she handled any other, swiftly and decisively. A moment later, she gave a determined nod and held out her hand to Thane.
I'm sorry about that,
she said.
I shouldn't have spoken unkindly, or tried to light you on fire.
Thane smiled and shook her hand between his thumb and forefinger.
Don't mention it.
No, truly, I feel terrible,
said the Solomancer.
Okay, but really, don't mention it,
said Thane.
Or me. Specifically, don't mention me.
But why keep the secret now?
Said Laruna.
I could introduce you.
No. If she was to react as you did, if she...
Thane trailed off as he looked back into the rippling waters of the stream. His reflection stared back at him.
We've been over this. I know what you all would prefer, but I'm not ready to show myself yet.
But...
Gorm put a hand on Laruna's shoulder.
Lass, sometimes you need to trust a friend to make their own choices, even if you disagree with them.
Laruna gave him a strange look.
But what if it's not just a disagreement? What if what they're doing is bad for them? What if it might be actively harming your friend, or even the rest of the party?
Aye, I know it's hard, and secrets are dangerous,
said Gorm.
But if you're to be a friend for someone, you have to respect their privacy. You can't be there for them any other way.
I guess you're right,
she said.
Good.
Gorm patted her shoulder.
Now come on. We'd best get back to camp before the others start asking after us.
It's just a few questions, said the Flaming Skull.
I know you're all eager to get back to haunting the ruins, but we really value your honest feedback.
Tyrin sat at a small table in the center of what had once been a cafe, though recent events had reduced it to a broken husk. The room had more gaps than walls, and through the cracks the former Knight Commander could see the undead shambling through the streets. The walking corpses seemed distant to Tyrin, but then everything did, as though he was observing himself from across a great chasm. If he didn't maintain his focus, fond memories of little Obby in Grandfather's castle would roll in like a fog. The whole sensation was reminiscent of being drunk, without the wobbliness or the uncontrollable impulse to say embarrassing things.
"Is everyone ready to begin?" asked the Flaming Skull.
The other participants seated round the table nodded and groaned in general agreement. The skull had gathered a motley arrangement of ex-humans. A zombie, a skeleton, a spectral man, the creeping shadow of a woman, and a portly ghoul with a familiar face and a new set of dreadful fangs. The toothy individual perked up when it saw Tyrin.
"Yeah, now, I know that armor," it said. "You're Knight Commander Athos."
Tyrin was about to reply, but the zombie cut him off.
"Lots of knights have floral armor, Ted. That can't be the sole basis of identification." "Well, he does have high cheekbones, Ted," said Ned.
"You're the two who were arguing about the organ," said Tyrin.
"Sir,"
said Ted, saluting. Ned gave a grin that was both horrifying and horribly smug.
"Although now we've seen the instrument for ourselves, so we can say with certainty, ahem,"
said the Flaming Skull, its baleful eyeball staring with disapproval at the ghoul and zombie in turn.
"If everyone will give me their attention, we can get started."
"Right, sorry," said Ned.
Several papers on the table in front of the floating skull rustled and rearranged themselves before it launched into some prepared remarks.
"Hello, I'm the head of marketing. You've been randomly selected to participate in this focus group. I'll be asking you a series of questions, and your answers will help shape undead invasions of other cities. So, be open, honest, and direct. Your opinion matters. Are we ready to begin?"
There was a generally assenting chorus of groans and moans.
"Great," said the Flaming Skull. "Now, how many of you saw one of these flyers before you joined us?"
One of the papers levitated into the air and flipped around.
Tyrin recognized the pamphlet and its promised doom at the hands of the dread Lord Dattar Ermion, so he raised his skeletal hand.
All of the undead around the table did the same.
"Good, good,"
said the head of marketing. It bobbled earnestly as it stared at the stack of papers in front of it, and lines of thin script burned into the parchment as if written by an invisible hand.
"All right. How would you say you felt when you first read it?"
The spectral man next to Nedard let loose a long, agonizing wail, as biting and cold as frost on a grave.
"Good! That's great!" said the head of marketing. "And what was your name again?"
The ghostly man just wailed again.
"That's our Spencer," said the shade of the woman. "He's a banshee now."
"Spencer the Malevolent,"
murmured the head of marketing. "Great! Now, who else wants to talk about the flyer?"
"I agree with Spencer," offered the skeleton.
"As usual, Rudge,"
muttered Nedard, leaning in close to Tyrin.
"I'll wager you've never seen a skeleton without a spine before, sir."
"Great," said the head of marketing. "Anyone else? How about you with the fancy armor? What's your name?"
Tyrin looked around, and as nobody else wore armor, fancy or otherwise, he answered.
"I am Knight Commander Tyrin Athos."
"We can work with that," said the skull, looking down at its notes. "Maybe Tyrin the Soul Drinker. Lord Athos, the Blood Guzzler, Bloodseeker, the Corpse—"
"What are you doing?"
Tyrin interrupted. The skull bobbed in a manner suggesting a shrug.
"Just a little rebranding. It's what I do."
"I don't really want a new name," said Tyrin.
"We'll work on it. I've got a few more ideas," said the head of marketing. "Now, how did you feel when you read the pamphlet?"
Tyrin thought for a moment.
"Confused,"
he said eventually.
"Hmm."
The head of marketing's voice conveyed the frown that his fleshless face could not.
"Care to expand on that?"
"It's just, why the paper?"
said Tyrin.
"It wasn't any more frightening than the horde of undead trying to break down the gate. Much less so, actually."
"I'd agree with that,"
said the skeleton.
"Rudge, you'd agree if we said your skull was swapped with your tailbone," snapped Ned.
"You're probably right," sighed Rudge.
"And what did it want me to do?" Tyrin continued. "It just told me to be afraid. I don't see what that does for anyone."
"It doesn't have a clear call to action," Ted offered. "Very important to have one of those in your advertisements."
"I'm familiar with the term," said the head of marketing frostily. "Anything else?" he added, in a tone that suggested there had better not be. The focus group fell silent, but the quiet held on too long to be mere awkwardness. Tyrin felt a twinge of something on the edge of his consciousness, like an itch in his peripheral vision. He looked around and saw that the other participants were sitting rigid and alert, staring straight ahead with blank expressions.
"Excuse me," said a hollow voice from behind the group.
The lich that had killed Tyrin ducked through the doorway. As the skeletal wizard approached, Tyrin's strange sensation became more intense, almost overpowering.
"I just wanted to have a quick talk about some of these proposed names," said Dutar Ermion. "Shouldn't take more than a moment."
"Absolutely, sir," said the head of marketing.
"Excellent," said Dutar. He looked at a small sheet of parchment. "I've been looking at your list, and, well, Grimblood Darkhost, Mortarion the Soul Reaver.
They tested well with previous focus groups," said the head of marketing. "Guaranteed to frighten anyone."
"Perhaps."
The lich tossed the paper into the air, and it disappeared in a small burst of green flame.
"They just seem so done."
"A tried and true approach, sir," offered the head.
"One for two, at least," said Dutar. "Why all this effort to scare the living? They naturally fear us."
"Oh, our research shows that fear has a powerful effect on morale," said the head of marketing. "Frightened troops are more likely to flee or make fatal mistakes in battle."
Dutara was unimpressed. "They're also more likely to make valiant last stands or to rise up against all odds in unlikely moments of glorious heroism."
"Yes, aha, but not as often as the fleeing or dying," said the head of marketing. "You can't win them all."
"Indeed, but I want to win more of them," said Dutar. "I think we need a new angle."
"Absolutely, sir."
Gobbets of flame dripped off the head of marketing like sweat.
"That's why we're running these focus groups with our latest recruits. Why, this group was just saying they thought different messaging would be more effective."
"Is that so?" said Dutar.
The lich looked around the room.
"Well, what do you say? Have you been having productive discussions?"
Tyrin wasn't sure what to say, and the rest of the group was still rigid and vacant.
"Sir, the Crown of Iron Thorns?" the head of marketing said helpfully.
"What?
Oh, right."
Dutar lifted the iron crown from his skull and tucked it within the recesses of his robes. Instantly, the focus group slumped in their seats, and Tyrin's strange sensation drained away.
"Now then," Dutar continued, "what do you make of all of these scary names and such?"
Despite the removal of the crown, however, none of the undead seemed inclined to speak. They cowered in their chairs, trembling.
"Come on, then," said the lich. "Isn't that what we're here for? To discuss our feelings and such? How are you doing since your recent transition? Anybody? Nobody feels anything? Not a twinge of emotion?"
Eventually, Neddard Biggins raised a shaking claw.
"Well, your majesticalness, I've been hungry mostly," he offered.
"Hungry," said the lich flatly.
"Well, since you asked, yeah," said Ned. "I think it's on account of my eternal curse to crave the flesh of the living."
"Oh yes, I feel the same," said Rudge.
Spencer and his shadowy wife nodded as well. The violet flames around the lich's head glowed brighter, and a sudden chill fell over the room.
"I see. That's the general consensus, then, our big insight. We wish there was more to eat."
"I must admit, it'd be nice if there were more brains available," said Ted the zombie.
"Well, we can all agree there," hissed Dutar.
The lich whirled on the head of marketing.
"And you've spent how much time and energy to arrive at this particular bit of perspective?"
"We've had, other valuable insights, sir," the head of marketing said, backing away like a cornered animal.
Why, Sir Tyrin had just been saying that he believes a call to action would have helped our last campaign."
"Is that so?"
said the Lich, turning his gaze on Tyran. Yes. Tyran was suddenly grateful for his decades of experience bluffing to those in authority. I mean, the Flyer didn't ask me to do anything. It just told me I was going to die and suffer for all eternity. And honestly, so far, being undead isn't that bad. A murmuring rose up among the gathered corpses. It's not that bad, said Datar. Not as bad as they made it sound, anyway, said Tyran with a shrug. I mean, it was a shock when it happened, and I'm still getting used to things, but my old knee injury doesn't hurt anymore, and it's the first time in ages I've woken up without a hangover. Plus, now what do I have to be scared of or worry about? The worst is already behind me, I suppose. The worst is behind you, said Datar slowly. What does that even mean? Hissed the head of marketing at Tyran. Yes, that's what I've always thought. Undeath only seems horrible until you've tried it, said the Lich. I think you may be on to something here, Tyran. I love it, said the head of marketing. Me too, said Rudge. Death is in your past. Disease and injury are mere memories, Datar said with rising excitement. You never age, never hunger, and never die.
I do hunger quite a lot, if you'll recall, Nedard ventured.
But the idea had passed the flashpoint, and now Datar's skeletal face was alight, even more so than usual.
You bend no knee to kings, pay no taxes, and live by no laws. All fears are behind you. You are as gods.
What, even Raj? Said Ted.
This changes everything, Datar said, excitement welling up from his infernal depths. What if the living saw undeath as a transformation rather than an end, a boon rather than a blight? Would they join our cause?
It's certainly got novelty, said the head of marketing.
This could be the most innovative thing in necromancy in ages, said the Lich. We could change the paradigm of necromancy on Arth.
The head of marketing nodded. And I love the idea, but...
But, said Datar sharply, am I to assume you don't know how to make this work?
Oh, no, I definitely can see how good,
said Datar. I have high expectations for you and Sir Urthos here. Make sure to keep him involved. The floating skull glared at Tyran with its lone eye so fiercely that its pile of notes burst into flame.
Oh, no, sir. I won't let this one out of my sight.
Well, I don't see any sign of him.
Gorm nursed a tankard as he watched the patrons mill about the tavern. The men and women in the room were dressed in extravagant bursts of bright silks and moved with the stiff precision characteristic of aristocrats and peacocks. It was the sort of establishment where a few dark figures skulking in the shadows in the back corner were sure to attract unwanted attention.
You sure this is the right place? Seems a bit posh for this business.
Oh, this is the place, said Bert.
The kobold reclined in a leather purse set on the bench between Katha and Gorm, sipping from a tiny tankard.
Beedrin's dream wants to be a gilded lily, but it's a copper-covered daisy at best. Maybe there's a couple of baronets in the crowd, but for the most part, these are all children of merchants and tradesmen. Jelana brought me here once on an official visit to Perald, and she swore we'd never return.
It just seems like a place where a group of mercenaries and a shadowkin might not be welcome, said Laruna.
Would you relax? Bert snorted. I'm in an elf's purse. Nobody's going to check my papers.
He gave Katha's arm a hearty pat for emphasis. Hand, said Katha, without looking up from her apple rose water.
Touchy,
grumbled Bert, withdrawing the offending paw.
Just the opposite, said the elf.
Gorm was inclined to agree with Bert. The ranger was on edge. He attributed her short temper to her mostly successful efforts to swear off drinking. The elf took a glass of wine at one or two rare moments of relaxation, but for the better part of a year now, she hadn't ordered anything stronger than water filled with diced fruits and flower petals. That kind of long-term sobriety might account for a lot of strange behavior. At least Gorm hoped it did, because Katha had a lot to account for as of late. He shook off his concerns and turned back to the conversation at hand.
Look, there's an undead army to the south. Vetchel's a pile of rubble by now,
Bert growled at the mages.
Word of the threat has already made it to Perald, and yet this lot is still here trying to maneuver into favorable marriages. If they can ignore an army of the dead, they won't be bothered by a few rough-looking folk in the corner. As long as you keep your head down, stay quiet, and play commoner to a bunch of wannabe nobles, you'll be fine.
So long as your contact shows up soon, Jin told the kobold, we've lost 2 days waiting around Perald as it is. In another 2, this city will be crawling with refugees.
Reconnaissance takes time, especially when you have to go through back channels to get to your source. But look, they're here.
Bert nodded to the front door, where a gaggle of elves in elaborate silks created a stir amongst the aspiring nobles. If your contact is the one in the violet gown, said Heraldin, I'll volunteer to ply her for information.
Don't be a scubber, Bert snapped. Look at her purse.
Gorm squinted at the violet-clad elf's drakeskin purse. A tiny canine face peeked over the handbag's golden rim. The kobold's gnarled features were dusted with white and rose-colored makeup, and the uneven tufts of fur sprouting from his malformed head had been sculpted into colorful curls with a variety of greases and dyes.
That's the strangest-looking purse kobold I've ever seen, said Lorena.
Yeah, ain't he a diamond in the rough?
Bert's sneer was one that only a kobold could achieve, a grimace impossible to perform with symmetrical features or eyeballs that pointed in the same direction.
Anyway, he's giving me the signal. Let's head out back.
What signal?
Gorm asked.
He's just sitting there. Right, acting like he doesn't see me. That's the signal, said Bert, settling into Katha's purse.
He gave the elf's sleeve a couple of quick tugs.
Let's go, Ranger. You should know all about making tracks.
He's just going to ignore you? Asked Lorena.
Seems to be a lot of that going around, hissed the kobold. Let's move it!
But what kind of signal is that?
The Solomancer reluctantly stood with the other heroes.
Anything else would be suspicious,
Bert said, glaring back at the other kobold once more.
Come on, you guys are taking forever.
An eternity, really, muttered King Handor. A small, agonizing eternity.
Indeed, sire,
whispered Weaver Ortson. The Grand Master of the Heroes Guild slumped in his chair, wearing the morose expression he always bore in the brief interlude between getting up and the day's first cocktail.
Look at all of the people, Handor muttered under his breath. Diplomats, finance ministers, accountants, every one of them is as dull as porridge in a gray bowl, and even they're bored to tears.
The least they could do is serve wine,
said Ortson. I suspect that would distract us from their meeting, said Handor.
Exactly, sire.
Ortson managed something approaching a smile. Below them, a nervous dwarf stood in front of a large graph, stammering about the financial distress of the old dwarven kingdoms. The chart itself was a square of oak boards with a grid of holes. The dwarves had set pegs in the grid and strung crimson twine between them, creating a red line that plotted the kingdom's finances. The whole graph was shaped like a mountain, but most of the dwarf's talking points focused on the treacherous cliff near the end. Handor sighed. The economic woes of the old dwarven kingdoms were well documented, beginning at the turn of the century, when imperial alchemists discovered a way to transform lead into gold. Within a few years, the empire's economy was so flooded with gold that the value of gold coins plummeted across Arth. The agekeepers said a grocer couldn't carry enough coin to buy a chicken. The imperial alchemists were summarily executed, and the freedlands in Ruskin barred trade with the empire for a decade. Shortly thereafter, Handor's grandfather, King Ovan the Wise, invented the gilton and separated the value of the freedland's currency from the scarcity of gold. Ruskin followed suit with its own currency, and the empire began to issue coins made from lead coated in silver. But the dwarves loved gold to a fault, and for ages the old dwarven kingdoms had built their nation on mining and exporting precious metals. They kept an iron grip on the gold standard for over half a century too long, hoping that the markets would correct themselves and gold would come roaring back. Yet when markets do correct themselves, the issue they most often correct is false hope. The dwarves saw their currency drop to a fraction of its former value. A collapsing currency is an enormous problem for a nation with more bottomless chasms than arable farmland. The rising price of imported food forced the dwarves in the mountainous old kingdoms to spend away their coffers just to keep their people from starving, and the kingdoms were now utterly destitute.
And so, as you can see, another generous infusion of aid from the Freedlands should allow us to remain solvent until the current economic difficulties have passed,
the presenting dwarf droned on. Handor started to sigh again, but he felt eyes on him. He turned to see King Forder Hvarthson, the king of Cadan Alt, watching. All the fathers, ancestors, and kings of the other clan homes in the old dwarven kingdoms were pledged to Cadan Alt, making Forder the most powerful dwarf in the world. Handor nodded to the dwarven king and made the pretense of giving the speaker his attention. A few agonizing minutes later, a page rushed to Handor's rescue.
"Your Majesty," he whispered breathlessly, "Sir Johan has an urgent message. He requests a word with you at once."
"Praise Tandos," muttered Handor. He made his excuses to Wartson, nodded to King Forder and his attending ancestors, and slipped out of the ballroom. Johan waited in a nearby hall, clad in a full suit of elaborate plate mail that dwarfed the ceremonial suits of armor lining the wall. "Johan," said Handor, "I'll never understand how you can wear that armor everywhere." "Your Majesty," said Tandos Champion with a small bow, "it is the fashion among professional heroes." "You're retired," the king shot back, "and it's the most ridiculous fashion I've ever heard of, to walk around girded for war every day." "One must always be prepared. One must always be exhausted and chafing as well," said the king, leaning against the wall next to Johan. "Gods, that looks heavy. The pauldrons are bigger than your head." Johan shrugged, causing the aforementioned pauldrons to eclipse his face. "They work miracles with enchantments these days, Your Majesty. They've woven enough sorcery into the steel that I don't notice the weight. And speaking of miracles, have you managed to save the old dwarven kingdoms once again?" "King Forder knows my terms," sighed Handor. "This whole meeting is just the first step of his clumsy counter. What's the sense in opening with a presentation that says the dwarves have no money? He may as well deliver an hour-long speech to tell me that the sky is blue." "Ha!" laughed Johan. "That would be more interesting than the dwarves' finances." Handor nodded. "What would impress me is if he could make a case for the Freedlands sending him more gold. We've been bailing out that foundering ship for over a decade. It's time for the dwarves to change boats or sink for good. Plenty of clan homes have sworn fealty to Andoran. If he wants the benefits of being in the Freedlands, he can do the same." Johan's perennial grin widened a bit. "Well said, sire." "If only we could say as much in those stuffy dinners," said Handor. "This one's so dull that even Marja made some excuse, and you know what it takes to keep her away from a banquet." "Ha ha! Indeed, sire. She would have come if she'd known you'd be making an appearance," the king smirked. It was no secret that Marja would have preferred to marry Johan 2 decades ago, after the paladin rescued her from the tower of Datar Ermion. It was also no secret that Handor would have preferred she marry Johan as well. They each had their own way of coping with a loveless marriage. Marja took comfort in eating mountains of tea cakes and other sweets, while Handor turned his attentions to governing and the occasional chambermaid. "I did not know I'd be coming myself, sire," said Johan, his tone more serious, "but I'm compelled to intrude by important news." "Well, I didn't think you came just to save me from that presentation," said Handor. "Is this about the trouble in Knife Vale, the dragon stirring again, or the lich near Vechel?" "Vechel, I'm afraid," said Johan. "We just received word that the city has fallen to the undead." "And the city was evacuated in time?" Handor smiled once the paladin nodded. "Good. And how are the markets reacting?" "Up 2%, sire." "Excellent," said Handor. "Send my condolences and an offer of help to King Clen. A vague offer. And have the generals ready the bannermen. I want the army ready to defend the Freedlands if Clen can't stop this from spreading to our territory." "I'll have them marching east within the week," said Johan. "Shall I notify Mr. Ortson that the Heroes Guild may have a new quest coming?" The king shook his head. "Let's meet with our associates this evening and discuss the guild's involvement with Weaver then. We need a cohesive plan to stop the undead.
"And, if I may presume, the optimal time and place to do so?" said Johann, grinning broadly.
"Of course," said Handor. "In times like this, when most men see challenges, great men see opportunities."